Hello, and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitah Laib. The JCPOA revival talks continue in Vienna. Even though many were of the understanding that the talks should have borne fruit by the end of February, that has not happened. Two major developments, though, have occurred. First, Iran and the IAEA have agreed to a roadmap to resolve all outstanding issues. But there seems to be a monkey wrench thrown into the revival talks. Russia wants written guarantees from the United States that sanctions on Russia will not damage its cooperation with Iran. Just a couple angles we will be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. But first, to get the latest on what is going on, Homa Leslie is a correspondent joining us from Vienna. Well, Homa, tell us about the IAEA chief's visit to Tehran, what was achieved there, and of course, any new developments that there has been one major one, which I'm going to ask you about.
Yeah, so we know that the negotiations here, the Vienna talks aimed at restoring the JCPOA, are still ongoing. As you said there, there was this expectation that soon we're going to have the foreign ministers come and make an announcement. A part of this, an important part, basically, of the disagreements or sticking points concerned the issue of Iran's safeguards cases under IAEA investigation. Now, with the trip made by Rafael Grossi, that has been basically seen as a positive move. It's been seen with optimism by the negotiators here because the sides have agreed on a roadmap to get these issues resolved. And Mr. Eslami, I think, did make it quite clear in the press conference in Tehran that that is a red line for Iran. It wants these cases permanently closed. And now there's a specific roadmap and timeline to get there. But now, you just mentioned there, this new issue, Mr. Lavrov making those comments has thrown a huge question mark over the whole process of the negotiations. But let's just make some aspects of it clear. Mr. Lavrov, in his comments, and I'm quoting here from the report, says, "We want to be able to have a free and full trade, economic and investment cooperation and military technical cooperation with Iran. We don't want these sanctions to affect that," which is making it quite broad. But at the same time, the Russian ambassador here, Mikhail Olyanov, who's engaged in the talk, the Russian negotiator, tweeted that he tweeted this after Mr. Lavrov's message. He said that he's met with EU coordinator Enrique Mora, and they have, and I'm quoting him here, they have raised a number of questions that need to be addressed now in order to ensure the smooth civil nuclear cooperation with Iran. So he's just put it in the framework of nuclear cooperation. We know, of course, that that nuclear cooperation under the JCPOA includes, for instance, the returning the Fordo plant into a research center with the help of Russia, the supply of fuel to the Tehran research reactor, the exchange of enriched uranium for yellowcake, etc. That's what we're talking about. And also, I'll just quickly mention here, Kaveh, if I can, one Western diplomat has already been quoted saying that if Russian demands for these guarantees just and purely pertain to the nuclear cooperation with Iran, as Mr. Olyanov is saying, then that, quote, can be managed. But this diplomat says if Lavrov is using this as a play to try and carve a huge hole out of the overall Ukraine sanctions, then that's a different story.
Okay, any reactions from Iran on this?
At the moment, we had one news story saying that an Iranian member of the team has said that this Lavrov position is not constructive, but this was strongly rejected by the Iranian team. And sources close to the team and members of the team said that this is a fabricated quote. And up until this stage, they have not made any comments about this issue. But I just like to quickly point out that as far as we know, they have said that these negotiations are continuing. And yes, I'm just trying to find the quote. What this source said was at the same time that Iran believes neither war nor sanctions are the solution to any crisis. At the same time, the expectation is that the talks and cooperation, as per the JCPOA, will not be influenced by international developments and sanctions regimes.
Thank you so much for that. I'm glad I asked you that then, because you clarified this point for us, especially on the Iranian side, that that was rejected. Homa Leslie there from Vienna, many thanks. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us, veteran journalist and writer Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Brussels. And also joining us is journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Hafsakar, Mustafa, let me first start with you. So February's come and gone, and no JCPOA revival has occurred, unlike what people thought. Now, we had the visit by the IAEA chief today to the Iranian capital, Tehran. But what we're looking at is a landscape which there are just too many ambiguities and doubts from the people who are from the outside looking in. And I'm asking you what your thoughts are so far in terms of where this stands. What are your thoughts?
Well, obviously, this has been a very, very long week. And what could have been a sort of a different scenario just a couple of weeks ago is now made very different because of the war between Ukraine and Russia and obviously the heavy sanctions regime imposed now on Russia. I think this is a very good development because it obviously gives Iran the upper hand. Remember, this is a time where energy prices are soaring and many European countries, namely Germany, which is the biggest economy in the EU, is highly reliant on Russian gas and can no longer access it because of the sanction regime. So now the Iranian gas and the Iranian market, in essence, is extraordinarily appealing to the EU, who must have regretted following so blindly the Americans in sanctioning Iran, and are obviously trying to get closer. So I think this is an incredibly positive development for Iran, because not only does it open up a new market, not only can this now put these heinous sanctions behind, obviously not all, because concessions will have to be made, but I think progress will have to be made. And obviously Iran now is in a far better position. So I think all in all, this is a very good week.
Okay, well, let's see what Elijah Magnier thinks. Elijah Magnier, we're looking at obviously the impact that I'm not going to get too much into the IAEA Iran deal, though maybe I may later, but the military execution of Russia on Ukraine has had impacts. And in this case, as our guests there said, perhaps it's going to have a positive return for Iran were this JCPOA revival to happen. Do you view it that way?
Yes and no, because President Putin said today that if we don't sell our oil, nobody's going to sell it. So it means that this is very clear that nobody is going to benefit from oil if Russia is under sanction in not selling oil and gas to those who are buying it already. However, on the other hand, if the deal is concluded, it has a positive influence on the market, because so far nobody said that Putin cannot sell its oil. And since the United States is the first, depending on the month, or the second largest importer of oil from Russia, and Europe the first in gas, so this is going to continue flowing. If Iran entered the market, and it depends when. Today, the Iranians are talking about making a deal with the International Atomic Energy Organization by June. So we're talking about several months ahead of us. The oil today has reached $118.5 a barrel. We don't know where this is going, how long the war in Ukraine is going to last, and if the sanctions are going to be lifted immediately and the Iranian oil is going to be part of the market from day one. All these questions are still pending on this signing the deal, approving all the guarantee that Iran is asking, clearing the problem with the atomic energy that was raised by several intelligence agencies saying that Iran has other four reactors or nuclear sites that are undeclared. All that is still pending and has not been resolved yet. So I think it is still early to say this is going to have a positive or a negative or no impact on the international market.
I need to make sure that I understood you correctly because I did a fact check here. I'm not coming up with the statement that you said there about Putin stating that if we can't sell our oil, nobody can. That is how I understood you saying that. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So let's take a look at what Hafsa Kara Mustafa, what Russia has said. First, the foreign minister, and some say it's a coincidence, but not, about the timing of when this came out, which says Russia wants written guarantees from the U.S. that sanctions on Russia will not damage our cooperation with Iran. The piece of news said Iranian official says Russia's demand is aimed at securing its other interests. Iran, however, based on our correspondence, said those are fabricated. Iran has made no official reply yet. But the piece of news is true about Russia's, I guess, from the foreign minister, wants written guarantees. What do you think about that? What's your reaction to it?
Well, I think this is a moment where, because of the fragility on the markets, that everyone who has an upper hand in this specific sector will go into will try and exploit it to the best of their ability. I think, in a way, Lavrov has indicated that he wants to continue relations and trade with Iran, which is obviously very good. It is also a way of giving the opposing side the opportunity to say, well, you know what, this is between you and Iran, that's none of our business. And I think if that's sort of an opportunity given to the other side, it's very positive, because it obviously means that the sanctions will start to be limited exclusively to what the EU, to what European Western nations have been demanding from Iran, namely on the nuclear program, but will reduce the impact of the sanctions with other markets. So I think all in all, it's a very understandable statement to be made by Lavrov, considering the situation and considering the situation on the gas markets today as things stand. And I don't think it's going to be a hurdle to the negotiations with Iran, precisely because at the moment, I do think that the oil producing countries do actually have the upper hand, considering the war is happening. And even if the war comes to an end within the next few days, I think the nature of the sanctions regime imposed by Western nations will not come to an end immediately. I think there's going to be a gradual step because, of course, major measures have been taken against the Russian economy. And I don't think that any negotiation now in regards to the war will have to be made incrementally. And therefore, in the next few weeks, any decisions that can be made by Iran will benefit Iran greatly, given the fragility of the market at the moment.
Okay. You seem to be optimistic on that. Elijah Magnier, to further expand on what the Russian foreign minister has said, he said the limitations had become a stumbling block, talking about the sanctions, I guess, for the Iran nuclear deal, warning the West that Russian national interests would have to be taken into account, and that the sanctions on Russia had created a problem from Moscow's perspective. How much of a problem has it become for Moscow vis-a-vis the JCPOA revival talks?
Well, there is a very important issue Moscow is raising here. Iran said it has 33 kilos of 60% enriched uranium and 27 kilos of 20%. And all that is Russia is supposed to buy it and sell it in the market. So Russia is asking for a written approval from the U.S. that this is not going to be included in the sanction and that it will be allowed to sell on the market the additional uranium and other products that maybe Russia would like to include. So what Russia is doing that in the midst of the highest sanction on Russia is really twisting the Americans' hands and saying, you can't do it without us. Even when you go to talk to the Iranians, you ask us to mediate. Like today, they are asking China, that is considered a strong opponent of the U.S., to mediate with Russia. So the Russians are saying to the Americans, you don't have to continue with your double standard. And if you want our support, so let us talk about all the sanctions that you are imposing on us. And this created a problem because it is linked to the Iranian nuclear deal. And it just a second front that is open on the JCPOA in front of the Americans, that the Americans also seems not in very much in a hurry when they say, okay, we need to confirm that these four sites are clear and they do not match the intelligence information we have. And all that is buying time to see how long Russia is going to stay in Ukraine and for how long this fight is going to last. Is it a few days, a few weeks, or several months? We don't know yet.
Well, talk about the time and it being speeded up or not, and the reactions by Iran and the other parties. Hafsakar Mostafa, I'm coming in at a different angle on the question I'm asking. And first, the German chancellor last week, while in Israel, said that this deal has to happen. It has to happen soon. It has to happen fast. Then we had today what Iranian nuclear chief Dr. Islami said, that no political influence and lobbying should impact the decisions of the IAEA. And then we had the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visiting Moscow, which I think that visit has already taken place or is still taking place. So I'm asking about Israel. What do you think? How much of a factor does Israel play? Oh, one other thing, Hafsakar Mostafa, I think it was 2 weeks ago, where you had a mini Israeli delegation actually visit Vienna. We're not too sure who sent invitations out to them to see what's going on there. And it was interesting to find that out when you have a regime that possesses nuclear warheads, but yet wants to find out that that Iran is getting limited or whatever they think Iran should be getting in this JCPOA revival. What do you think about the Israeli factor here?
Well, can I just say that this week, which has been incredibly rich in events, has also exposed a lot of hypocrisies. The nations that have actually invaded and violated the sovereignty of numerous nations, including Iraq, including Libya, that are now lecturing Russia and Putin on its violation of Ukraine's sovereignty. So I think nothing in terms of hypocrisy is surprising. And of course, Israel's decision to actually attempt to stop any development in the nuclear sector by Iran, given that it itself possesses 200 nuclear warheads, and was admitted also by Ehud Olmert in 2002, because many people still insist that, that's a sort of an open secret, but it's not. Actually, it isn't. The Prime Minister of Israel admitted that it had nuclear warheads. So whatever the Israeli position is, I think it needs to be set aside. And I think at the moment, given that it's in a very difficult position, because of course they have affinities with the Ukrainian president, who is a Jewish pro-Israel leader, and they also are in a difficult position in terms of their relationship with Russia, which is very, very close given the huge Russian community in Israel. Their position now is far weaker, and therefore I think we can set them aside and not really give them much importance, other than perhaps the influence they can have on the US Congress. But coming back to the negotiation in terms of what's going on today, I think, again, this is a very rich and eventful week. And I think whatever decisions, major decisions can be made, and major achievements on the Iranian side will have to be made within the next few days. Because, of course, everything is in a flux at the moment, precisely because we don't know where the war is heading. And therefore, this is the opportunity, this is the window that will allow this sanctions regime to be reduced.
Well, you know, when you think about this in the hindsight, what Iran has asked for, Elijah Magnier, is that it wants guarantees on a whole host of issues, but one of the biggest ones is the fact that it doesn't want or wanted guarantees for the U.S. not to pull out of this, something the U.S. says, I can't guarantee you that. And this conflict that has happened, the Ukrainian conflict, shows that here we have, and I'm not saying that Russia is throwing a monkey wrench here, but in a sense it is, how external factors are going to affect this JCPOA revival talks. How can there be guarantees, something that Iran has asked for, and you can use the Ukrainian conflict as one example. Is that even possible?
Well, this is a very good example in this period, a very critical period in the world where there is a war between Russia and Ukraine. And the origin of this war is in 1990, U.S. Secretary James Baker promised Mikhail Gorbachev at that time that NATO will not expand one inch. In 1993, Warren Christopher also promised Boris Yeltsin exactly the same thing. 1997, we have documents exchanged, all that revealed by the American National Security, and we understand written or non-written agreement or verbal agreement, the United States is not respecting its deal. There are many, many agreements in the world that in throughout the history that the Americans did not respect. So when the Iranians are saying, I need a guarantee, it's really not standing on robust ground, because the United States can offer written guarantee, but that has very little value, because with a new president like Donald Trump, what he did in 2018, in 2025, the same thing can be repeated with another president. So there are no guarantees. And this is what Iran is asking today. And it has to keep some buffer, like the enrichment uranium or whatever buffer Iran is asking. Now, I'm not going to discuss it. As a guarantee under the control of the International Atomic Energy in Iran that will be used against the United States and regain the production of enrichment uranium above 3.67 in case the United States doesn't respect this deal.
Okay. Well, talk about guarantees. We're looking at, I think, a contagion here, Hafsakar Mostafa, because lo and behold, we have another party to the deal. If this news is accurate, and it came from a reputable organization that has come out with news that has been false, China, in which two diplomats, one of them not directly involved in the talks, said it also is demanding written guarantees that its companies doing business in Iran would not be affected by U.S. sanctions. Next thing you know, you're going to have Germany saying the same thing, maybe, and then the EU coming out wanting guarantees from... I mean, this whole thing with guarantees then is out in the open. But let's just stick with what China has said. So now you have China, now you have Russia. Both know that the U.S. has pulled out of the deal before. So how can it get guarantees from the U.S. where it can trust it?
Well, just to pick up on the point of the other panelists, I completely agree. I think that the U.S. cannot be trusted. But this is where coming back to the idea that this is a window of opportunity, and it's a very short window. But I also think, and perhaps call me overly optimistic here, but even China's remark, which does come across as sort of throwing a spanner in the wheel, is actually very positive, because this means that these countries and their intelligence services and their economists and all their analysts have actually been observing the situation and can see that the Western nations are now in a position of weakness. I think they went too far in their sanctions regime against Russia. And they realize that now, especially at this time of year, and especially in the terms of the sectors that it's impacting, it's going to be just as biting to Russia, if not to Western economies. And therefore, all these other countries are now making the most of it and actually imposing their diktat on a Western position that is far, far weaker as a result of the speed that it took in making these hasty decisions to go against Russia, precisely because, of course, it had no intention of going in militarily, given that in the last 50 years, we've only seen Western nations go up against much, much weaker countries and never, ever actually confront very powerful nuclear nations.
Very well. Thank you, indeed. Thank you so much for that. Hafsakar Mostafa from London, journalist and political analyst, and Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution, veteran journalist and writer from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tahway. It's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright. and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the absolutely merciful, the especially merciful.
وقال الرسول يا رب إن قومي اتخذوا هذا القرآن مهجورا
And the messenger will say, O my Lord, verily my people deserted this Qur'an.
The 30th verse of the chapter states, وقال الرسول يا رب إن قومي اتخذوا هذا القرآن مهجورا And the messenger will say on that day, O my Lord, verily my people have treated this Qur'an with neglect. In the previous program, we mentioned that this verse is talking about the complaint of the Prophet, which is still heard on the Day of Judgment. He is complaining to Allah about a group of Muslims who have neglected the Holy Qur'an, who have neglected this life program that has been bestowed upon the people from the Almighty Allah. Only its words are nicely recited, seen, and used as tiles for architecture of mosques. There are some points to be discussed about this verse, dear listeners. This noble verse refers to the complaint of the Prophet ﷺ. And because he is mercy for both worlds, rahmatun lil alamin, he does not cast curse. Although he is complaining, but he does not cast curse. Imam Ridha alayhi salam has said, The reason that we read the Holy Qur'an in ritual prayers is for paying attention to the Holy Qur'an. So this is the true meaning of Holy Qur'an. It's not just for recitation. It has been put by the infallibles, by the Almighty Allah, in our ritual prayers to pay attention to its words. For example, an Islamic narration recommends to read 50 verses of the Qur'an every day, and your aim must not to be reaching the end of the surah. So, we should read slowly, we should strike our heart with reading the Qur'an. Whenever we are surrounded by temptations, we have been recommended to resort to the Holy Qur'an. When the temptations, problems, and difficulties like night have engulfed us, we are to resort to the Holy Qur'an.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد
الأسد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
One important point, dear listeners, when we are talking about some of the Islamic countries neglecting the Holy Quran, we should not exclude ourselves. Maybe it seems proper to mention a few confessions of some great people about how this Holy Quran is neglected. For example, Mullah Sadra says in the introduction of Surah Al-Waqi'ah that I have read the books of many philosophers, so that I thought I knew all things, I became an important man. But when I began to perceive a little of the true nature of situations, I found out that I knew no real and true knowledge. At the end of my lifetime, I embarked on pondering the Holy Quran, the narrations of the Prophet and his household. Then I became certain that what I had done up to then was baseless, because during my life I was standing in shadow instead of being under the light. Then he continues saying, I became wholeheartedly sorrowful, and then divine favor was bestowed on me. I became familiar with the secrets of the Holy Quran, and I began to comment on it. I began to ponder the Holy Quran. I knocked the door of revelation till curtains were taken away, doors were opened to me, and I saw the angels say to me, peace be upon you, you are good, therefore enter it to dwell therein forever. Also, Faiz Kashani, may his spirit be sanctified, says, I had written many books and articles, but none of them were remedy for my pain, and no water I found to quench my thirst. I got worried about myself. I resorted to Allah and repented, so that Allah led me by means of pondering the Holy Quran and Islamic traditions. Brothers and sisters, it is important to notice that the relationship of mankind and heavenly book must be perpetual. It must be in all aspects. When the Holy Prophet says, إِنَّ قَوْمِ اتَّخَذُوا هَذَا الْقُرْآنَ مَهْجُورًا, this word mahjur has been taken from the word hijr. This word is used when there is relationship between man and that thing. So we must try to do our best to pay attention to the Holy Quran and set it our scientific and practical base in all dimensions of our lives. That is how we can get to satisfy the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
EU foreign affairs ministers held yet another emergency meeting on Friday evening in Brussels to take stock of many Ukraine-related issues. The flow of refugees into EU nations was discussed at length. The impact of recently announced Western sanctions on Russia was assessed.
We are not under regime change. The sanctions are not in order to provoke a regime change in Russia.
Borrell says the sanctions are in fact designed to end the deadly conflict. NATO foreign ministers also met on Friday and reaffirmed their stance of not being drawn into the war. They acknowledged the results could be catastrophic. However, NATO allies continue to send thousands of additional troops into eastern parts of the 30-nation alliance.
And we have over 130 jets at high alert and over 200 ships from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Experts say the US is controlling all of the West's next moves, and the decision to supply deadly arms to Ukraine was a mistake.
The Europeans are saying to the Ukrainian, we're not going to send men to fight with you, we're not going to fight by your side, we give you weapons for you to fight. And had that not happened, President Zelensky would have talked to Russia from day one and avoided this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken attended all of the key events in Brussels on Friday, focusing on Ukraine.
Unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, this may not be over soon. And so these efforts that we're making together, we have to sustain them.
A number of political commentators are saying this crisis could have been averted if Russia's legitimate security concerns had been listened to. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Western media coverage of the conflict in Ukraine has come under the spotlight over what's seen as racist comments by journalists and their guests talking about the crisis affecting the Ukrainian people.
Me, I'm sorry, it's very emotional for me because I see European people with blue eyes and blonde hair being killed, children being killed every day with Putin's missiles and his helicopters and his rockets.
And so, of course, I understand and respect the emotion.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
We're not talking here about Syrians fleeing the bombing of the Syrian regime backed by Putin. We're talking about Europeans living in cars that look like ours to save their lives.
People across the world were quick to react to those comments.
I support Ukraine. I'm also upset at Western leaders for being hypocritical when it comes to taking action for Yemen and Palestine. A Ukrainian's life isn't worth any more or less than that of a Palestinian or Yemeni. We are all equal. We must condemn war everywhere. If you support Ukraine but not Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, if you condemn Russia but not Israel and the U.S., then congratulations, mate. You're on the highest tier of hypocrisy. Where were NATO, the USA, and their people when Israel was killing innocent Palestinian children? It's not Ukraine. It's Gaza. But no one stands for them.
Social media platforms have also been filled with comments criticizing different approaches by European countries in dealing with refugees. The Ukrainians fleeing the conflict in their country have received a warm welcome by their neighbors, including Poland. No problem with that. But these European states had a totally different stance back in 2015, when an influx of refugees escaping poverty and violence in Africa and the Middle East reached Europe. Some European authorities have even drawn a distinct line between the two groups of people.
These are not the refugees we are used to. Ukrainian people are Europeans. These people are intelligent. They are educated people. This is not the refugee wave we have been used to. People we were not sure about their identity. People with unclear pasts who could have been even terrorists.
Race and nationality again become important when people fleeing the Ukraine war are received. There have been reports of Africans being turned away at the border by security forces. Some of the journalists that were caught red-handed ended up apologizing for being, quote, insensitive. But questions remain that whether being a European means the mainstream media will be more likely to talk about their distress. Many may now hope that having darker skin or being from a certain religion doesn't make others ignore their pain and suffering.
It is unusually cold in Italy for early March. Forecasters have predicted freezing weather will hit the country from north to south over the next 10 days. Italians have been told not to worry about low temperatures for now. Their homes will be heated through the winter season. However, things could be very much different in the coming future. The government, led by Prime Minister Mario Draghi, has recently issued a decree in which, besides introducing a state of emergency over the conflict in Ukraine, it also referred to possible gas rationing following its decision to do without the Russian gas. Italy imports about 95% of its gas, 45% of which is coming from Russia.
Technically, Italy is already in a state of gas supply emergency. There is a plan in place at the Energy Ministry which features three levels of intervention. The country will resort to the maximization of its fossil fuel generated power in the first place. It will take years for Italy to replace Russian gas supplies. In the short term, only about one-third of the gas provided but Moscow can be sourced elsewhere.
In the wake of the Ukraine crisis, Rome is looking to boost gas supplies from other international partners. Italy is paying dearly for not having diversified more its energy sources and its suppliers throughout the years.
In an attempt to reduce Italy's dependence on Russian gas, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio has recently been to Algeria to discuss ways to increase gas supplies. Algeria is the second supplier of gas to Italy.
Italy held a self-destructive attitude when it came to diversifying its energy sources in the past. We used to have great gas suppliers such as Libya and Iran, but these countries were either thrown into a war or heavily sanctioned in the name of NATO's interests. And for this reason today, we depend very much on Russia's gas.
While the EU is expected to unveil a new energy strategy to reduce its member states' dependency from Moscow's gas, on Friday the Italian Foreign Minister Di Maio warned that if Russia thinks it can blackmail Italy on energy, then they've got their own country. According to some geopolitical experts, European countries must keep into account that Russia would be capable of turning off gas supplies to the old continent. Max Civili, Rome.
A huge number of Ukrainian refugees continue to arrive at EU borders in Poland, Slovakia, Romania and Hungary. On Thursday, EU Home Affairs ministers adopted the Temporary Protection Directive. It means the refugees can work and go to school in any of the bloc's 27 member states
for at least 1 year.
If you compare to the refugees that came in 2015, how long time it took to have the proper decisions. For example, just to have their asylum applications processed, it could take years.
So, by the EU's own admission, refugees travelling here from conflict zones involving Western military powers did not and do not receive the same protection. Meanwhile, advocates are calling on the EU to pay particular attention to certain groups.
In general, people who are displaced in a forced way are vulnerable. But we want to call attention to specifically the situation of women and girls because they are disproportionately affected.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen travelled to Slovakia and Romania on Thursday to assess the refugee crises facing the two EU nations. She took the opportunity to try and apply additional pressure on Moscow.
The three waves of sanctions we introduced are already having an impact on the Russian economy and therefore Putin's war effort. And we will take additional steps if the situation deteriorates on the ground.
Non-EU country Moldova has taken in more than 100,000 Ukrainian refugees so far. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell visited the country on Thursday to offer support. However, there is concern over the treatment of some who are trying to reach the EU from Ukraine. Senior UN officials are criticising evidence of discrimination by EU border authorities against African and Asian nationals attempting to flee the conflict. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
Al-Fajr cultural days have kicked off, but this time it is not held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Rather, Beirut is hosting the event like many other Iranian art exhibitions held here.
Activities include many art activities, theater, music, exhibition, seminars and other activities.
The Iranian Minister of Culture opened the festivals with an awe-inspiring musical concert. Iranian musicians there are glad to be attending such an event.
I'm a musician from Iran. I play oud, a common instrument in Muslim world. I really like the Arabic culture, Arabic countries' cultures. By myself, and I think the collaboration between Muslim countries, it would be good. Something like Fajr days in Lebanon, and I really enjoy my stay in Lebanon.
The many facets of Iran's artistic culture have come all the way to Lebanon, from the folklore dress to post-Islamic calligraphy.
This exhibition is for Iranian exhibition for the Iranian handicraft for before Islam and after Islam.
According to organizers, this event is significant in that it represents part of collaboration between Iran and Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The World Bank has recently approved a plan to use more than $1 billion from a frozen Afghan trust fund for aid in Afghanistan through UN agencies and charities. Afghan experts welcoming the move suggest that there should be a clear mechanism for disbursing the money so that Afghanistan gains the greatest benefits.
Allocating $1 billion as aid is a piece of good news for Afghanistan, but there should be a clear and appropriate mechanism so that the money is not wasted like hundreds of billions of dollars that were poured into Afghanistan in the past 20 years. I think, first of all, the UN should come to an understanding with the Taliban. Then they can assess needs or create jobs through developmental and fundamental projects.
This comes as unemployment, poverty and hunger crises are deepening in Afghan society. Afghans expect the Taliban and international community to create job opportunities, calling for unfreeze of Afghanistan's frozen funds and more aid to the country.
We have been experiencing a very harsh winter. Many died of hunger and illnesses. We neither have a job nor received humanitarian aid.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and large global funds to the country were halted.
Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul. Turkey has closed the passage of warships through its straits of Bosphorus and Dardanelles. The decision was taken after Ankara called Russia's military action in Ukraine a war. President Erdogan said Turkey is using the authority given to it by the 1963 Montreux Convention Pact on passage of its straits to prevent the escalation of the Russia and Ukraine conflict.
Turkey is determined to use the authority given by the Montreux Convention on Turkish Straits in a manner to prevent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Erdogan said he was very saddened by Moscow's attack on its neighbor, describing the move as unacceptable, adding that Turkey will not abandon its ties with both Ukraine and Russia. The Turkish defense minister, in his turn, asked all sides to respect the international pact Turkey has worked by, assuring that it is Ankara's right to limit passage in the straits in wartime. Kiev had already asked Turkey to close its straits to the Russian warships. The move will prevent more Russian ships from reaching the Black Sea, from where it had launched attacks on Ukrainian southern coast. Analysts say Turkey's decision does not only help Ukraine but also Russia, as the decision prevents all warships, not only Russian ones, from crossing the straits.
Turkey is following a balanced policy between the two countries. The president already clearly stated that Ankara will not take side and stand with neither Russia nor Ukraine. However, enforcing the Montreux Convention is an international procedure, which will not affect Russia negatively, and Ukraine had already asked for it, hence Turkey will not be put in a position to choose sides. However, Turkey already rejects the Russian military action.
Turkey maintains good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, as it bought S-400 missiles from the first and sold the drones to the second, and does not seem willing to risk taking sides in this conflict. It seems that Turkey is trying to remain impartial in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, while it's trying to mediate to end the fight, with President Erdogan making some calls and pushing for a political solution. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Home Office has verified that the majority of people trying to reach the UK's shores via the English Channel are fleeing war and persecution. This comes in response to allegations made by the Home Secretary that the majority are illegitimate, in her own words, asylum shoppers.
If the laws that they're trying to put through Parliament at the present time, if they had been in process at the time that the present Home Secretary, Priti Patel, the time her family came as refugees and asylum seekers from Uganda, they would not have been allowed to come into the United Kingdom. Or if they did come into the United Kingdom, they would be put into some sort of detention camps that she is advocating.
The issue of Ukrainian refugees also got off to a rocky start, with the Home Secretary suggesting they could benefit from fruit picker visas. Now, under pressure, the government is offering emergency visas for those with family members already living in Britain. But at the same time, the government is pushing through legislation that will criminalise those coming from the Middle East and Africa, specifically via the English Channel, and people protesting this are getting mixed responses.
It's interesting that while we've been reporting here today, we have heard people pass by making some pretty off-colour remarks about refugees arriving here in this country. And that just confirms that there is a lack of sympathy here. And some would say those sentiments stem from misinformation, but most importantly, from racism.
White skin, blue eyes. They've said it on the media. White skin, blue eyes means you're acceptable. If you're brown-skinned or black-skinned, you're not acceptable. And it's a form of apartheid.
There are people who have been driven to suicide after arriving in Britain. There were actually more people dying after being in the hands of the Home Office here than the numbers that had been dying crossing the Channel. And that is crazy to think that the hope and the aspiration that drives a person to risk their life, the kind of Britain that they're hoping for, is the one we want to live in. But it's not the one we have. It's what we have is deeply driven, divided by racism.
The Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK extraordinary powers to criminalise, prosecute and imprison refugees, and give the Coast Guard immunity from prosecution if refugees die at sea. there have been widespread protests demanding this bill be scrapped, specifically now that the government is poised to issue hundreds of thousands of visas for Ukrainians, proving that when there's a will, there's a way. Bianca Rahimi, London.
British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's licence to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik, as well as their subsidiaries, will no longer be able to spread their lies to justify Putin's war and to sow division in our union.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship, and the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time, but observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome back to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha, and we'd like to thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very important subject and examining a question that, you know, people often ask regarding the benedictions that we send upon the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam and his holy progeny. Specifically, we would like to ask and pose this question in the following way. You know, most of the times when we send our salutations upon the Prophet Muhammad and his family, we do so together, meaning we send our salutations upon the Prophet and we send our salutations upon his progeny and his family, the Imams, alayhimus salam, and his daughter, the Lady Fatima. Right. So the question we want to ask is there any specific virtue and benefit in sending our salutations upon the Lady Fatima specifically or not? Fortunately, we have a very blessed tradition and hadith which has been related from the Lady Fatima